December 26th, 1983, Austin, Texas. After leaving her workplace, 39-year-old Gracie Nash vanishes without a trace, and her abandoned car is soon discovered with a large amount of blood inside. Just over 1 month later, Gracie's brother, 43-year-old John Davis Jr., is fatally shot outside his residence. Suspicion falls upon a woman named Naomi Easley, who launched a campaign of harassment and violence against the victim's brother Melvin after a tumultuous breakup. Even though Naomi eventually goes to prison for another murder, no evidence links her to John's death, and Gracie remains a missing person. After that, the trail went cold. Hello, everyone, and welcome to our latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host, Robin Warder, and on today's episode, we're going to be exploring a truly bizarre story involving two separate victims, the 1983 disappearance of Gracie Nash, and the subsequent 1984 murder of her brother, John Davis Jr. As I'm sure you know, one of this podcast's biggest influences is the missing persons website, The Charlie Project, run by Megan Good. There have been multiple occasions where I've stumbled across a write-up of an obscure, lesser-known case on The Charlie Project, which left me with such a WTF reaction that I instantly felt compelled to put together an episode. This story is filled with so much drama that if it took place today, then it's possible that true crime shows and podcasts might be jumping all over it, but when it originally took place, it really didn't garner much media coverage at all outside of Austin, Texas. Gracie Nash and John Davis Jr. were siblings in a large, working-class black family from Austin, who would suffer through several months of torment after their brother Melvin Davis broke up with a woman named Naomi Easley, who responded by launching a harassment campaign against him. Things escalated to the point where Naomi shot and wounded Melvin, and it was while Naomi was awaiting trial for the crime that Gracie went missing and John was murdered. Well, needless to say, given Naomi's history of violent, unstable behavior, a number of people suspected that she might have been responsible for what happened to Gracie and John, but law enforcement just could not uncover the evidence to prove it, and both cases are still unsolved to this day. What makes this story particularly jaw-dropping is that if you believe Naomi Easley was responsible for these crimes, you'll probably be wondering why she was given so much free rein to do what she did. So this episode is also going to be exploring how the system might have failed the Davis family in a huge way. Anyway, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including iTunes, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, which may include stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. So with all that out of the way, let us now explore the shocking saga of Gracie Nash and John Davis Jr. Our story begins in Texas in 1983, and our first victim is 39-year-old Gracie Nell Nash. Gracie hails from a very large family and is the fourth child of her parents, John Henry Davis Sr. and Annie Mae Davis. Now, I've seen conflicting information from different sources about how many children the Davises had, as some articles state that they had 15, while others say it was 17. However, I saw at least one article specifically use the phrase, quote, 15 living children, so this might mean that the Davises had two children who had already died before these events took place. Either way, that's still a hell of a lot of children, but it sounds like the Davises were a close, tight-knit, hard-working family who never caused any trouble. After getting married at a young age, Gracie had a son and daughter of her own, but she eventually got divorced and is now living with her parents at their residence in the town of Manor, which is a suburb of Austin. Gracie's two children are both in their early 20s, and she has recently become a grandmother, as her daughter Barbara and infant granddaughter are currently living in the same residence with her. Gracie also has a steady boyfriend, and for the past decade, she has worked as a nurse's aide at the East Fair Nursing Home on Martin Luther King Boulevard in Austin. On December the 26th, Gracie drove to Austin to pick up some medicine for her granddaughter, and after dropping it off at her family's residence in Manor, she drove back to Austin to work her shift at the nursing home, which ran from 3 until 11 p.m. Since this was an uncharacteristically cold day for Texas, ice had materialized on the road, so one of Gracie's sisters phoned her up at work to suggest she leave early. In spite of this, Gracie worked her entire shift as planned and was last seen leaving the nursing home at around 11:15 p.m., but she failed to return home and was not heard from again. Since this was very out of character for Gracie, her absence caused great concern for her family, which only increased when her mother Annie Mae received an odd phone call the following morning. According to Annie Mae, she heard a muffled female voice tell her, quote, "If you want to see your daughter alive again, tell your son to drop charges against the woman," end quote. Gracie was soon reported missing to the Austin Police Department, and while her vehicle, a 1971 green and white Chevrolet, was no longer at the East Fair Nursing Home, her necklace was found in the parking lot, suggesting that a struggle might have taken place. On December the 28th, the abandoned Chevrolet was discovered in the parking lot of the New Manor Apartments on 22nd Street. A coat that Gracie had just received for Christmas was inside the vehicle, along with large amounts of dry blood. This made investigators suspect that someone had been shot, and there was so much blood, they found it unlikely the victim could have survived. Gracie's boyfriend was not considered to be a suspect in her disappearance, as he frequently visited her family and seemed pretty devastated by the situation, but the Davises had their own ideas about who was responsible. As you recall, Annie Mae had received an anonymous phone call demanding that her son drop charges against the quote-unquote woman, who happened to be 27-year-old Naomi Easley, the former girlfriend of Gracie's 33-year-old brother, Melvin Douglas Davis. The couple had an on-again, off-again relationship for years, and had even lived together for 5 months, but in May of 1983, Melvin decided to break up with Naomi, and she did not take it well. He soon received a letter from her which read, quote, "You've hurt me too many times. Now every time you hurt me, I do something to hurt you. I don't understand what's happening to me. I love you. I hate hurting you, but I can't seem to stop. I feel like I'm losing my mind. I'm slowly losing control of myself. When I left you at the park, I went to a pawn shop and bought a gun, then to Academy for bullets. I had in my mind I would threaten to shoot you if you did not start treating me better. This is the final straw. I realize now if I keep going this way, I will end up hurting you physically, possibly killing you. I know in my heart that I do not want to do that." End quote. For the next 5 months, Naomi essentially did everything in her power to make Melvin's life a living hell, as she tried to get him fired from his job at the city's electric department by writing letters to his supervisors, and she threatened his life several times. At one point, Melvin said he even caught Naomi pouring sugar and syrup into the gas tank of his car. Melvin resided at a house in Austin alongside his 43-year-old brother, John Henry Davis Jr., who was the oldest sibling in the Davis family, and also worked at the city's electric department. Since both brothers were amateur auto racers, John owned a 1965 Chevrolet Nova race car, but one day, he discovered that the car's tires, as well as the tires on the trailer used to haul it, had been slashed. On July the 15th, Melvin went to work and found Naomi waiting there for him, where she pulled a .38 caliber pistol out of her purse. Melvin managed to wrest the gun away from Naomi, and when he refused to give it back, she went to her car and grabbed a butcher knife, which Melvin also managed to take from her. After Melvin contacted the authorities and turned the knife and gun over to them, a justice of the peace placed Naomi under a peace bond. However, this did not seem to bring an end to the harassment, as John returned home from work one day and discovered that someone had broken into the house, slashed his clothes, and tried to set a fire in his bedroom. Shortly thereafter, the garage behind the residence was set on fire, completely destroying John's race car, which was being stored inside. On October the 30th, Melvin and John's younger brother, Ronnie Davis, showed up at their residence while they were gone, but heard the noise of someone inside. While he was walking back towards his car, three shots were fired at Ronnie from the house, but all of them missed, and it does not sound like Ronnie was able to get a look at the shooter. Things finally reached their boiling point at around 8:20 p.m. on the evening of November the 18th, when Melvin exited the residence to walk to his car and saw a figure emerge from around the corner of the house who was dressed all in black and had covered their head with a scarf. Melvin instantly started running away, but the person proceeded to pull out a .38 caliber pistol and fired a couple of shots at him. One of the shots wound up striking Melvin in the wrist, but he managed to make it to a nearby house and call for help. After Melvin identified Naomi as the shooter, she was quickly arrested and charged with aggravated assault with a deadly weapon before she was released on bond to await trial. During the early morning hours of November the 21st, only 3 days after Melvin was shot, John was exiting the house to head to work when someone fired several shots at him from a distance. Much like the incident with Ronnie, all of the shots missed John, and he never actually got a look at the shooter. It would be just over 1 month later when Gracie went missing, and since the anonymous phone call had mentioned the charges Melvin had filed against Naomi, suspicion instantly fell upon her, but Naomi's lawyer would not allow the police to interview her about Gracie's disappearance. Well, history would repeat itself shortly after 6 a.m. on the morning of February the 3rd, 1984, when John exited his house to leave for work, and three shots were fired at him. But unfortunately, these shots did not miss, and wound up striking John in the head, stomach, and right shoulder, killing him instantly. Since Melvin had been spending the night at another location, there were no witnesses to John's murder, and even though Naomi was questioned about the crime, there was no evidence to implicate her. 1 month later, Naomi went on trial for shooting Melvin, and by this point, in addition to assault with a deadly weapon, she had been hit with the additional charge of attempted murder. While Melvin was allowed to testify for the prosecution, the court ruled that he was not allowed to make reference to Gracie's disappearance or John's murder, since Naomi had never been charged with either of those crimes. The prosecution could also not mention the attempted shooting of Melvin's brother Ronnie, since Naomi was never positively identified as the assailant. Naomi took the stand to testify on her own behalf, and while she did admit to such acts as threatening Melvin with a gun and a knife, slashing his tires, and attempting to get him fired from his job, she denied ever shooting him. Her alibi was that she had spent most of the day at home alone before she drove to her sister's house and arrived at 9 p.m., about 40 minutes after Melvin was shot. Naomi also attempted to paint an unflattering picture of Melvin, claiming that he had threatened to beat her and tie a rope around her neck to drag her behind his truck. During closing arguments, the defense pointed out that there was not one piece of physical evidence which placed Naomi at the scene of the shooting, and even though a pistol belonging to her had been taken into evidence following her arrest, it turned out not to be the same gun which shot Melvin. When the case went to the jury, they deliberated for 6 hours, but found themselves hopelessly deadlocked and unable to reach a verdict. The vote was 9-3 in favor of a conviction, but what further complicated matters is that 6 of the jurors who voted guilty thought that Naomi should be convicted of aggravated assault, while the other 3 felt she should be convicted on the attempted murder charge. Even though Melvin had identified Naomi as a shooter, the jurors who voted not guilty thought he may not have seen her clearly because the shooting took place at night and there were poor lighting conditions at the scene. As a result, a mistrial was declared, but rather than go on trial for the second time, Naomi agreed to a plea deal 3 months later, where she would plead no contest to the aggravated assault charge and receive a sentence of 10 years probation. Her defense attorney stated, quote, "My client really couldn't bear to go through another trial, emotionally or financially. She still maintains her innocence," end quote. In 1986, Naomi got married to a man named Kent Moore, but the relationship would gradually go downhill, and by the end of the decade, the couple had split up and was in the process of divorcing. On the evening of November the 5th, 1989, Kent phoned the police to report that he had been receiving harassing phone calls from his wife and was concerned for his safety because of her past history of violence. Well, sure enough, during the early morning hours of November the 6th, Naomi showed up at Kent's residence and proceeded to shoot him 5 times with a small caliber handgun before fleeing the scene. Kent survived long enough to be taken to the hospital for treatment, and before he died 1 hour later, he managed to positively identify Naomi as the shooter, and she was subsequently charged with his murder. When Naomi went on trial in September of 1990, Melvin appeared as a witness for the prosecution and testified about her past behavior. The jury only deliberated for 5 hours before they found Naomi guilty of murder, and she received a 75-year prison sentence. Over the past 3 decades, Naomi has been up for parole on multiple occasions, but has been denied each time, and she is still incarcerated to this day. In 2006, the Austin Police Department announced that they were reopening the investigation into Gracie's disappearance and John's murder, but while they've taken such steps as collecting DNA samples from surviving members of the Davis family, it sounds like they haven't made much headway. Even though suspicion remains that Naomi Easley was responsible for both crimes, no conclusive evidence has ever implicated her, so John's shooting continues to remain unsolved, and Gracie is still technically a missing person. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. So like I mentioned in the intro, this is one of those cases which I had never heard of before until I just happened to stumble upon the write-up for Gracie Nash's disappearance on the Charlie Project, and immediately thought this deserved to be the subject of an episode. There aren't a lot of sources available which provide information about this case, as it was mostly just covered in the Austin American Statesman newspaper, but given all the drama and the twists and turns involved, I can't help but wonder if this case might have gotten a lot more attention if the Davis family and Naomi Easley were white. While details about the Davises are fairly limited, it sounds like their patriarch, John Davis Sr., was a man who worked very hard to provide for his family as a farm laborer until he was incapacitated by a stroke, and he instilled these same values into his many children. During an interview in the Austin American Statesman, John Sr. said, quote, "Me and my wife tried to raise our kids right. You can ask anybody around here. None of our kids ever caused trouble. Gracie didn't bother anybody. She didn't go to beer joints. She didn't use drugs. She only went to work and back home. We can't figure it out." End quote. Indeed, Gracie was often described as the quote-unquote backbone of her family, as she would always run important errands and do pretty much anything to help them. Before she went missing, it sounds like Gracie was helping care for her parents, her daughter, and her granddaughter, and her boss at the nursing home considered her to be a model employee. And when John Davis Jr. was murdered, he was described as a guy who loved working and racing cars and always paid the rent on time without causing any issues. From what I can tell, the Davises were pretty much just your average, law-abiding, working-class family who did not have any drama in their lives until Melvin Davis broke up with Naomi Easley. I've already bemoaned the lack of media coverage about this story, as Gracie's disappearance did not get any attention at all until it was featured in an article in the Austin American Statesman on January the 31st, 1984, just over 1 month after she went missing. But I find the timing to be very interesting because it was 3 days after the publication of this article when John Jr. was shot to death. Couple that with the attempted murder of Melvin in late November, and the Davis family just had to endure an unspeakable amount of tragedy in a short amount of time. And, well, if you believe Naomi was responsible for everything, one of the most outrageous things about this story is how preventable these tragedies were. But before I start talking about the case, I want to mention one interesting little tidbit from that aforementioned article in the American Statesman. If you're an Unsolved Mysteries fan, you might remember their segment about the 1982 disappearance of 18-year-old Sherry Eyerly from Salem, Oregon, which was investigated by a Dallas-based psychic named John Ketchings. During this time period, Ketchings was often called upon to assist with police investigations in Texas, including this one. The Davis family actually sent some of Gracie's jewelry to Ketchings, and he told them that he believed Gracie had been stabbed to death and her body was covered with shingles near an old building in a green field. Unfortunately, that description was so vague that it didn't really help investigators find her remains, and let's just say that Ketchings has become a bit of an infamous figure among Unsolved Mysteries fans. During their segment about the disappearance of Sherry Eyerly, they showed how Ketchings had confronted a potential suspect named Daryl Lee Wilson, and during his interview, Ketchings uttered this memorable line, quote, "I knew that he knew that I knew that he was responsible for this," end quote. Well, Wilson wound up taking his own life only a few hours after Ketchings spoke to him, but years later, it turned out that an entirely different suspect was responsible for Sherry Ierley's disappearance, and Wilson had nothing to do with it. Needless to say, this left a huge black mark on the so-called psychic abilities of John Ketchings, so I would not put much credence into his observations about Gracie's case. Hell, he expressed his belief that Gracie had been stabbed to death, even though the pattern on the dried blood inside her car made the authorities believe she had been shot. Indeed, if you believe Naomi Easley was the perpetrator, all of her other known crimes involved her using a gun. Even though Naomi was never charged with shooting John Davis Jr., and technically only entered a no-contest plea to shooting Melvin Davis, we do know that she used a gun to murder her husband, Kent Moore, years later. If Naomi really is guilty of all these crimes against the Davis family, then at least they can take comfort in knowing that she's probably going to remain in prison for the rest of her life, though I'd argue that she never should have even been in a position to marry Kent, let alone kill him. It is very surprising that after agreeing to enter the no-contest plea, Naomi received a sentence of 10 years probation and got to avoid jail time. I guess the state's rationale is that they couldn't prove the attempted murder charge and could only get her on aggravated assault with a deadly weapon, but really, the one reason things didn't turn out much worse for Melvin is because he happened to see Naomi emerge from around the house and started running before she could fire at him, which is why he managed to escape with a gunshot wound to the wrist. Otherwise, Melvin likely would have been the victim of cold-blooded murder. And even though Naomi always denied shooting Melvin, she flat out admitted on the witness stand at trial that she was responsible for other incidents in which she threatened and harassed him. If nothing else, this demonstrated a pattern of dangerous, unstable behavior on her part, which should have merited at least some time in prison. I haven't heard if any further harassment against Melvin and the Davis family took place following Naomi's plea deal. Even under the terms of probation, I find it surprising that someone with that much rage could just stop, but it looks like she eventually wound up letting it all out on poor Kent Moore after he decided to divorce her. Of course, I also believe that Naomi never should have been released on bond after she was arrested for shooting Melvin. I mean, yes, I guess the evidence against her wasn't clear-cut, since the gun was never recovered, and Melvin's identification of Naomi as the shooter probably wasn't airtight, since the perpetrator was wearing a scarf over their head, and the crime took place at night in poor lighting conditions. But that doesn't change the fact that there was already a documented history of harassment on Naomi's part before she was arrested. Remember, she had already showed up at Melvin's workplace with a gun and a knife, and wound up being placed under a peace bond, which is a court order that requires a person to keep the peace and be on good behavior for a period of time. Naomi technically violated the peace bond on numerous occasions before she even shot Melvin, and if that was taken into consideration following her arrest, Naomi should have remained incarcerated until the case went to trial, and Gracie and John might still be alive today. Officially, Naomi has only been charged and convicted of the murder of her husband, but if she also murdered Gracie and John, that would technically make her a serial killer. I would really like to learn more about Naomi's background prior to her breakup with Melvin, as I'd be curious to know if she had a previous history of violence or erratic behavior. That letter she wrote to Melvin is so unsettling, and her need to not only destroy his life, but the lives of other members of his family, paints a picture of a truly disturbed, unhinged individual. All that being said, since Gracie and John's cases are still unsolved, we have to look at this whole situation objectively and operate under the assumption that Naomi is innocent until proven guilty. I do have to acknowledge that Gracie's disappearance seems to be quite different from the rest of these crimes and is the most puzzling aspect of this story. Since John lived in the same house as Melvin, I can understand how he would have gotten caught up in the crossfire, but why was Gracie targeted and what happened to her body? Given the amount of blood found in Gracie's abandoned vehicle, it's surprising that anyone would have gone to the trouble of getting rid of her body to begin with. It also seems like a lot of work for someone like Naomi to dispose of a body so thoroughly that it hasn't been found in 4 decades. She definitely seemed like a pretty sloppy and disorganized criminal, as her other plan simply involved showing up at Melvin and John's residence and erratically firing shots at people. Remember, we also have the incident where their brother Ronnie showed up at their home and was shot at 3 times. And only 3 days after Naomi was charged with shooting Melvin, someone fired multiple shots at John as he was leaving for work in the morning, which is the exact same circumstances of how he wound up being killed over 2 months later, except this time, the shots missed. The presence of Gracie's necklace in the nursing home parking lot seems to indicate that some sort of struggle took place before Gracie was abducted in her own car, but if Naomi was the perpetrator, why would she go to the trouble of doing this rather than simply shooting Gracie outside her workplace? Under different circumstances, I might be willing to explore the possibility that Gracie's disappearance was unrelated to the drama involving Naomi, and she was abducted and murdered by an entirely different perpetrator. But it's really hard to overlook the fact that her mother, Annie Mae, received a phone call the following morning from someone who said that her son needed to, quote-unquote, drop the charges against the woman if she wanted to see her daughter alive again. According to Annie Mae, the voice of the female caller was muffled, so I guess she could not positively identify her as Naomi, but who else could it have been? Does anyone honestly believe that a completely different woman abducted Gracie and made this phone call about dropping the charges against Naomi, but Naomi herself was completely innocent and had no knowledge or involvement in what happened? And given that Gracie's disappearance had not yet received any media coverage at this point, there's no way that call could have just been a hoax. So this makes me wonder if perhaps the reason Naomi went to the trouble of abducting Gracie is because she legitimately believed that if she held Melvin's sister against her will and threatened her life, Melvin might actually be compelled to drop the charges. But then something went horribly wrong, and Gracie was shot to death inside her car. Yes, this definitely would not have been the most rational and logical plan, but Naomi was not a rational person. There was speculation that Gracie was already dead by the time the morning phone call came into her mother, which would not have been a wise thing to do since it tied Naomi to the crime, but it's possible she was getting off on tormenting the Davis family. Now, given her other legal troubles, it sounds like Naomi's defense attorney would not allow the police to question her about Gracie's disappearance, but I'd be really curious to know how thoroughly she was investigated. Did the police look into her whereabouts on the night of the crime and see if she had an alibi? Given that Gracie was presumably abducted and murdered in her own car before it was abandoned, I wonder what Naomi would have used as transportation to the nursing home and how she made it back home. In case you're wondering, putting ankle monitors on offenders who were released on bond did not become a thing until 1986, but even so, I wish the police had been able to watch over Naomi during this time period, or at the very least, put surveillance on Melvin and John's residence, given how many violent incidents had already occurred there. If more precautions were taken, then perhaps John's murder could have been prevented. Now, I previously mentioned how Gracie's disappearance didn't seem to get any coverage in the media until the Austin American-Statesman published a story about her on January the 31st, 1984. That particular article did briefly mention the possibility that the case might be connected to Melvin being shot by a woman back in November, but it didn't mention Naomi's name or any details about their tumultuous breakup. But of course, John wound up being murdered on February the 3rd, and when the American Statesman published an article about it the following day, they published Naomi's name for the first time and went into great detail about a repeated harassment of Melvin and John over the past several months. So if Naomi was responsible for killing John, let's try to put ourselves into her shoes. She's currently less than 2 months away from going on trial for shooting Melvin, and even though the newspapers have hinted that she's a potential suspect in the disappearance of his sister, they saved her some undue publicity by not revealing her name. But then a few days later, she decides to commit another murder, ensuring that her identity and all of her dirty laundry are going to receive some press. All of this publicity could have conceivably had a negative impact on her upcoming trial, but Naomi got lucky that the court would not allow Gracie and John's cases to be mentioned by the prosecution. So what could have been the motive for her to kill John at this particular point in time? Did she become angry because Gracie's disappearance and Melvin's shooting got publicity in the papers? Or was her anger actually driven by the fact that the papers didn't publish her name, so she decided to commit another crime to get some attention? Unfortunately, even though Naomi seemed like the obvious suspect in John's murder, it doesn't sound like there was much the authorities could do about it, as John was killed during the early morning hours where there were no witnesses around, and since the murder weapon was never found, no evidence technically placed Naomi at the scene. However, it's worth noting that Melvin had been spending the night elsewhere and was absent when John was killed, so maybe Naomi showed up there with the original intention of shooting Melvin and John was simply in the wrong place at the wrong time. This could have been a situation where Naomi had hoped to coerce Melvin into dropping the charges against her by kidnapping his sister, but when that didn't work out, she decided to kill him instead, as the case likely never would have gone to trial without Melvin's testimony. But then again, Naomi was such a vindictive person, maybe she thought the best way to punish Melvin was to let him live and endure the grief of losing two siblings. I know that Naomi finally got her just desserts and went to prison for the murder of her husband Kent, but a lot of lucky breaks had to occur before this could happen. Remember, after he was shot, Kent lived just long enough to positively identify Naomi as the assailant before he died, but if this hadn't happened, it might have been difficult to conclusively tie her to the murder. It was actually Naomi's own arrogance which helped pave the way for her conviction, because following her arrest, she wrote a pair of letters to the pastor of a local church in which she urged him to provide her with an alibi by testifying he was with her on the night of the shooting. Otherwise, she would tell everyone they were involved in a sexual relationship and wrote, quote, "The ball is in your court. You make the next play. You can make it easy or you can play hardball and we all get battered and bruised. The choice is yours," end quote. Well, this strategy backfired in a huge way because the pastor decided to turn these letters over to the authorities and denied ever having a sexual relationship with Naomi. The pastor wound up testifying as a witness for the prosecution, and these letters turned out to be pretty damning evidence at Naomi's trial. Hilariously enough, if you search online, you can find a legal appeal from Naomi's defense team who argued that the letters should have been inadmissible as evidence because they were privileged and confidential communications to a clergyman. However, the Court of Appeals ruled that this logic did not apply, since Naomi had not written these letters as a request for guidance from a spiritual advisor, but rather as an attempt to threaten the pastor's reputation and blackmail him. I know that Naomi has been denied parole on multiple occasions, and when I did a Google search on her name, I discovered that she had filed a civil rights lawsuit in December of 2019. While I was unable to pull up any specific details about this lawsuit, it was dismissed by a judge just over 1 month later, so it sounds like Naomi is still continuing to do whatever she can to cause trouble from behind bars. This is one of those stories where I would like to attempt to explore alternate theories about what happened to the two victims, but when you look at all the facts, the only explanation which makes sense is that Naomi was responsible for what happened to Gracie and John. However, since both these cases are technically still unsolved, this story was still worth exploring on this podcast, and it also functions as a bit of a time capsule for an era in which stalking, harassment, and domestic violence were not taken as seriously as they are today. I hate to say this, but I think that the authorities may have downplayed a lot of Naomi's actions because she was a woman, because of the genders were reversed, and a man had been responsible for a lot of the things which happened to Melvin and his family following the breakup, more precautions might have been taken to ensure their safety. So at this particular point, barring the unlikely possibility that Naomi might make a full confession and reveal what she did to the two victims, what can be done to solve both these cases? I know that Gracie's daughter Barbara is still looking for answers about what happened to her mother and would like to recover her remains, and the Austin Police Department did decide to reopen the investigation over 15 years later, though I'm not sure how much progress they made. I know that DNA testing was not yet a thing in criminal investigations back in 1983, but I'm wondering if new testing could now be performed on some of the key pieces of evidence in this case, such as Gracie's necklace. If traces of Naomi's DNA were found on the necklace, or it turned up anywhere inside Gracie's blood-soaked vehicle, this could conclusively prove that she was complicit in her disappearance. Or perhaps there's someone out there with knowledge about what happened who could break the case wide open if they come forward. So if you happen to have any information about the disappearance of Gracie Nash or the murder of John Davis Jr., please contact the Austin Police Department at 512-974-5000. That's 512-974-5000. But if you just have your own thoughts about what happened, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Now the reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. This past month, I released a bonus episode about the death of a man named Joseph Mulvaney, a murder victim whose skeleton was discovered inside a footlocker 3 decades after he was killed, and if you're an Unsolved Mysteries fan, you're probably familiar with their segment about this story, which is often referred to as Gabby's Bones. I'm also going to be dropping the occasional exclusive bonus Patreon episode from my spin-off podcast, The Path Went Chilly, and we recently released an episode in which myself and my co-hosts, Jules and Ashley, discussed another case from Unsolved Mysteries, the 1987 disappearance of Dale Kerstetter. And for our patrons in Tier 3, I've recorded another new audio commentary track, which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries. I'd also like to take a moment to give a shout-out to our most recent listeners who have signed up with us on Patreon this week, and they are Brian A., Jackie, Marty Ray, and Melanie. Thank you all so much for your support. I'm also pleased to announce that The Trail Went Cold has been added to the lineup for Podcast Row at 2 CrimeCon events this year. So provided that it is safe enough to travel, I'll be appearing at CrimeCon 2022, which is being held at Paris and Bally's in Las Vegas from April the 29th until May the 1st. If you would like to purchase tickets, we already have our own personalized promo code to receive a 10% discount off a standard batch. Please visit crimecon.com and enter the promo code TRAIL. I'm also hoping to appear at CrimeCon UK, being held at the Leonardo Royal Hotel and Spa in London on June the 11th and the 12th. If you would like to get a 10% discount on tickets to this event, please visit crimecon.co.uk and use the promo code COLE22. In addition, I wanted to provide another reminder that I hold live streaming sessions on a platform called Get Vocal. Every Thursday night from 7 until 8 p.m. Eastern Time, I host what is essentially an after show for each week's podcast episode, where I have an interactive discussion about the featured case from said episode and answer questions and address comments from listeners. I always include a link to these sessions in our show notes, so be sure to check there for more information or visit getvocal.com. That's getvocal.com. I just wanted to give another shout-out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. I need to provide a big thanks to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. So have yourself a good week and join us next Wednesday for another brand new episode of The Trail Went Cold. We'll be right back.